Warning. The system has become unstable.
This whole system is deeply flawed, and that's why I talk a lot about free markets and property rights, Austrian economics, and getting rid of the Fed. All these things are now up for grabs. A lot of people, especially the young people, are looking at this. So for this reason, I'm a bit encouraged by, what might come out of this. But I think we're going to go through the ringer. I think it's going to get much, much worse, and it's bad enough already. But there's no way that we can step back. The one thing I'm convinced of after having spent so much time in Washington is that this will not be a gradual recovery from this disaster that we have. We're not going to elect enough people and enough courage to vote the right way, and there's too much demagoguing and too much misunderstanding that people would revolt. But the collapse will come, it's going to hit the dollar, and then we're going to have our opportunity. So the more people who are protected intellectually as well as financially, the better off we'll be in rebuilding what we'll have, what we'll need to do in the near future.
Buckle your seatbelt. It's time for another episode of the Prepper Recon Podcast. I've personally been buying gold and silver from JM Bullion for over 2 years. They offer the best prices over spot that I can find, and I've never had a problem with an order. If you're looking to trade in some of your fiat paper for real money, check out jmbullion.com today.
Our individual first aid kits are now on sale. They're Mali-compatible pouches in Coyote, ACU, OD, or Black. They're equipped with an Israeli battle dressing, quick clot, TK4 tourniquet, suture kit, and lots of extras. It's perfect for your car, bug-out bag, or home first aid kit. Go to the PrepperRecon.com homepage and click on the IFAC store tab at the top of the page. They're on sale for $89, and that includes shipping. This kit could save your life.
Today's guest is the creator of SurvivalBlog.com and the author of the Patriots book series, James Wesley Rawls. Jim, welcome back on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Oh, absolutely. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Now, when we get events like the Ebola outbreak, we often see a new group of people become interested in preparedness. And it can be very overwhelming when a person first wakes up and sees the need to get prepared. Where should those folks start?
Well, I don't want to sound biased, but I do have a web page, a subpage on my own website at my survival blog site that's titled Getting Started. And if people go to survivalblog.com and then look in the left-hand bar, there is a series of text links to static pages. And there's one titled Getting Started. If they click on that, I have some pretty good suggestions there for people, basically to prioritize their preparedness. You're right, it can be really overwhelming for people who are just getting started, who realize just how behind the power curve they are and how much they need to do to provide and prepare for their families. And I hope that webpage does a good job of introducing some people to some of the basics. And then beyond that, I also have a full spreadsheet. It's what I call my list of lists. And that's also included in that left-hand bar at survivalblog.com. People can click on that. And you'll need Excel on your computer to open it or anything else, any other spreadsheet program that can open a .xls file. But that has quite a bit of detailed information for people to prioritize, again, in detail, what they need to do to prepare their families for any number of potential situations.
And the basics that we would need just to be ready for anything from like a hurricane to basically to the zombie apocalypse is going to be, I think that you coined the phrase beans, bullets, and Band-Aids.
Yeah, that's basically it. People need to think in terms of food storage, water filtration, self-defense, and medical supplies are probably right near the top of everyone's list. And it's important that people, of course, shepherd their funds. You don't want to go overboard in one area versus another, especially if you have a limited budget or a short period of time to prepare. It's really important that people hit all the main areas of preparedness early on and sufficiently to provide for their families.
And now the administration seems to think that Ebola isn't really that easily spread and that we don't really have that much to worry about. But now prior to 2008, Ben Bernanke said on CNBC that he didn't think we would have a housing crisis. Then when it became obvious that we were having a housing crisis, he said he was sure that it would be contained to the subprime market. Should we trust the government and the talking heads on Ebola, or do you think we have a little bit more cause for concern?
I think we should absolutely not trust the government. And if the government has proved anything, it's their extreme incompetence. And with agencies like FEMA, their absolute inability to respond. I'm often quoted as saying that FEMA actually stands for foolishly expecting meaningful aid. And I think that's the way we need to keep the government in mind, that they're really not there to help. In fact, FEMA's primary mission is not civilian or civil preparedness. Their primary mission, and it's not very well known, is actually continuity of government. That is their overriding priority above and beyond everything else.
So they just have to keep enough voters alive to have a staged election.
Well, they just want to make sure that all the heads of state are well protected and that all of the machinery of government is going to continue chugging along no matter what happens. Some of their plans are kind of ludicrous, and a lot of them date back to the early Cold War days, but don't depend on FEMA to do anything, especially in the event of a widespread disaster. And pandemics definitely fall into that category. FEMA has proved itself over and over again to be unable to even respond to localized emergencies. If something were to happen nationwide or globally, there's just absolutely no way that they'd be able to respond. And folks are going to be in what I refer to as yo-yo time. Yo-yo is an acronym that stands for you're on your own. And that's the way that people need to prepare. They need to have, again, their beans, bullets, and Band-Aids squared away in depth. It's the deep larder concept, so that you can live independently for an extended period of time. And water filtration is at the absolute top of that list, because no matter what situation you're talking about with disruption, water is paramount, and the need to be able to find open sources of water, transport it, and filter it so it's drinkable has got to be at the top of everyone's priority list.
And what do you think are a few common sense ways that people can sort of avoid ever being exposed to Ebola?
Well, the most important thing would be isolating your family. I know that a lot of people, unfortunately, are tied to jobs that require them to work 9 to 5 in a corporate environment, and they're going to have to be in touch, in contact with other people. But for any of your listeners that are self-employed or who are retired, for example, they are actually very well situated, unless a virus can be carried on the wind, which very few are. Most of them are spread by bodily fluids or, in some cases, casual contact. And we're not sure exactly where Ebola sits on that spread of threats, just how casual a contact it could be. But if someone is in a stage of life where they can isolate their families and virtually just basically lock their door, or in the case of people who live out in the country, lock your front gate and put up a sign that says, you know, sorry, no visitors, and UPS and FedEx and US Mail leave packages in this crate. And, you know, you can just buy an old pallet crate and flip it on its side and have that sitting out at the county road for your folks who live out in the country. And then when you bring your mail in, you're going to want to be in at least limited protective posture, you're going to want to at least have a mask and gloves and goggles. So when you handle mail or handle packages, every family should have a few utility spray bottles. You can get them for, you know, you can buy them at a five and dime store for 80 or 90 cents a piece in quantity. And several jugs of Lysol that you can dilute. For packages, you'd of course want to spray down the exterior of the packages, let them sit for half an hour, flip them over, and hit the other side. For your letters, just you would want to have a designated bag, a disposable bag that you would carry the mail in, and you would discard your gloves as you come into your house. Grab, as the gloves come off, you're going to grab that bag from the other end of the bag that you've been handling, and then put the mail, that whole bag of mail, directly into your microwave oven, set it on high for 90 seconds, and then you've got pretty well sterilized mail. That'll kill most viruses, including Ebola. And then you can feel safe to open your letters. Every family should be ready to do that sort of thing. And the protective posture that you'll need for a virus that has a persistent transmissibility by contact, if the virus is in contact with packages, for example, or packages of groceries or whatever, it persists. In the case of Ebola, apparently it can live for days on the exterior of something. You're going to need to have lots and lots of disposable nitrile gloves. You'll want to have plastic booties that you can slip over your shoes. And you'll need those in large quantity. I'm talking a couple hundred pair. And that way you can don those before you go out to handle packages or mail or handle anything that anyone else has been in contact with. And then you need to shed those, and you have a designated container for them to go into. Probably a burn barrel right outside your just a few paces from your door is probably the safest thing to do. And then once every week or two, you just touch that barrel off with a little whiff of diesel fuel. But you want to be able to hunker down, isolate your family, and to get back to our first topic, the people who are just getting started at this, boy, we're talking about a lot of logistics, not just protective gear, but how about a 6 or 8 month or 12 month food supply for your family? That's a lot of volume, a fairly large expense. Not everyone can afford that. And as I mentioned before, not everyone is at a stage of life where they can live independently. But if times get really bad, if a virus, and I'm not talking about just Ebola here, I'm talking about any viral outbreak. If there's a very high lethality rate, people have to kind of weigh the pros and cons. And if it looks like it's going to have a high lethality rate and it's highly transmissible, people need to seriously think about just, you know, phoning in their resignation at work and saying, I'm sorry, I really hope that you are willing to hire me back in 6 months or a year when this thing burns itself out, but my family has to come first. I'm just plain staying home. And that, of course, leads to another area of preparedness. That is, people need to be debt-free, and they need to have a cash reserve, and they also should have some ammunition and precious metals available to barter with. It's a lot to think about.
Yeah, and that's a great argument for frugality and maybe, you know, couponing and cutting your cable bill and doing some other things and making a savings plan a priority to where maybe you can put back a 3 month or a 6 month emergency savings cushion to where if you had to lose your job, it's a little bit easier to make that decision to call into work and not expose your family to the virus by being out and exposed to it yourself, if you've got that cushion of savings.
That's right.
So maybe we could say it's beans, bullets, Band-Aids, and budget.
Yeah, another B for you. Yeah, it is important that people live debt-free. You know, I often have people write me, and they say, oh, well, Mr. Rawls, if mass inflation is coming like you're predicting, why shouldn't I just max out my credit card to prepare? Well, who's to say how long deflation might continue? It might persist for another 3 or 4 years before we flip over into mass inflation. So, and in a deflationary environment, debt is a very, very bad thing. That's what's going to get you kicked out of your house. So it's really important that people get debt-free if they can. And if it means selling your jet ski, selling your 68-inch plasma high-definition television, skipping the cruise, skipping the trip to Europe, selling your Mercedes and buying a beater-looking old car that's in good mechanical condition, selling off your trinkets, I'd say go for it if you can get yourself out of debt.
And when people wake up to one potential threat, sometimes they suddenly become aware of a myriad of potential threats to our way of life. One event that repeats throughout history is economic collapse. How likely do you think something like that is?
Well, I'd say that while there's just a chance of a viral contagion in our lifetimes, the chances of a economic collapse in our lifetime, I think, are greater than they've been since the 1930s. We are on the precipice of a collapse. In fact, I'm surprised we haven't already seen a collapse. But the administration, with the cooperation of the private banking cartel called the Federal Reserve, have conspired to basically zero interest rates. And that has artificially kept the stock market afloat. It's kept the consumer economy afloat, and it's kept the real estate market afloat. If it weren't for that zero interest rate policy, we would be in the depths of a second Great Depression right now. All they're really doing is forestalling the inevitable, and they're making the inevitable depression that much worse. It's going to be that much deeper, and it's going to last that much longer because of the absolute mountain of debt that they've accumulated.
And what are a few specific preparations that we can make above our basic level of preparedness for an economic collapse?
Well, I think the most important thing is, in case the collapse is deflationary at first, people should be debt-free. But beyond that, it's important that people have a cash reserve. And here I'm just talking small bills, ones, fives, tens, and twenties. For basically a couple months worth of pay, keep that on hand. I'm a big believer in pre-1965 silver coinage for barter purposes, and I'm also a really big believer in common caliber ammunition for barter purposes, because if things get really bad, people aren't even going to want silver. They're only going to be looking for food and ammunition. And if you have really common calibers, and here I'm talking 22 long rifle, 38, 357, 9mm, 45 for pistols, 223, 308, and 7.62 by 39 for rifles, and just plain old 12-gauge shotgun shells for shotguns, those common calibers are going to be worth practically their weight in silver in the first few weeks of a full-scale collapse.
And do you think that ammunition as a barter currency, do you think that that's something that should be limited to your mutual assistance group and your community? Is there any chance that...
Well, it depends on where you live. If you live out in the boonies like I do, where all my neighbors for miles in all directions, and there are not that many of them, I live in a very lightly populated area, are fairly trustworthy folks. They're all fairly self-sufficient. They're fairly conservative. Most of them are God-fearing. I wouldn't have any reluctance at all in bartering ammunition. But if I lived in a suburb, I would be very reluctant to barter with anyone other than trusted friends. Because you never know, if you're bartering guns and ammunition in a situation like that, if that same gun is going to come back pointed at you someday.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. KB Armor offers affordable body armor, including level 3 trauma plates made of AR-500 steel. They can endure multiple rounds from pistols and rifles up to 7.62 NATO. Their plates are available with Rhino Linings coatings to reduce spaw. Go to katiearmor.com, that's C-A-T-I-armor.com today. And silver's at a 5-year low, and a lot of analysts are saying that it's far below the cost of production.
It is. It's a great time to buy silver. And, yeah, I was supposed to see it dip below $17 an ounce the other day. It bounced back this morning, but anywhere below $18, I would consider silver a very strong buy. And again, for any of your listeners who are newbies, don't buy a silver ETF. You don't want an exchange traded fund. You want the physical metal in your personal possession at home. And you want to have it in small, recognizable, trusted units. You don't want 100-ounce Engelhard bars or even 10-ounce bars, because that's too compact a form of wealth for day-to-day transactions. For day-to-day transactions, if you say you want to buy a can of beans or a loaf of bread or whatever, we're talking more like dimes, silver dimes and silver quarters. And again, all those that were minted in or before 1964, what are commonly called pre-65 coins, are all silver. They're 90% silver with a hardener added to give them more durability for circulation. People recognize those coins, and it's actually the older coins that show some wear that will be the most trusted, because the people who fake coins are usually faking very high-grade numismatic coins, things like Morgan dollars, silver dollars. Dimes and quarters have not been faked that much, and the few that are faked are not, they don't look worn. So a well-worn coin, I think, in a barter situation is actually going to be much more trusted than a brand-new shiny coin.
Now, do you think that if we did see an Ebola outbreak or some other type of a viral outbreak, do you think that that could be a catalyst for an economic collapse?
Oh, absolutely. It's not just preppers who are going to be thinking about staying home from work. It could be a lot of people, depending, again, on the lethality, the transmissibility, and how widespread it gets. My greatest concern would be a full-scale economic collapse, which would be triggered by public utility employees failing to come into work. It takes a certain level of staffing to run a natural gas-fired power plant or a coal-fired plant. It's a lot of people. And for nuclear power plants, the level of staffing is set in concrete by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. If you don't have a certain level of staffing, by law, nuclear power plants have to be scrammed and shut down. So that's worst case for people not showing up to work. But if the wheels of commerce stop, If a certain percentage of the population either is no longer breathing or no longer showing up for work, the big machine could just basically grind to a halt. And if that happens to the point where there's large numbers of refugees leaving the cities, it could be quite bad. And if it gets to the point where public utility employees don't show up and the power grids go down, all bets are off. Then especially if the power grids go down in the fall or winter, we could see massive loss of life in less than a year. We could see a 60 or 70% die-off of the population by some projections.
And then another concern that we've had lately, Chase was just breached. We've also seen Home Depot and Target breached this past year. You worked as a military intelligence officer. How concerned is the U.S. government of a cyber attack against the U.S. banking system or critical infrastructure?
It's huge, as is a directed energy weapon in a place like Wall Street or the parade plots in Zurich or places like that where there's a lot of banking computers. Whether it's a physical attack with EMP or whether it's a cyber attack with a virus, it's a huge threat, and it's one that's actually underrated. And the scary thing to me is to think that they have these development centers in China, in Russia, and even in places like Pakistan, where the governments have hired large groups of hackers, and who knows what they're putting on the shelf in terms of super viruses that could just basically, you know, wipe out the banking infrastructure. Who knows what cyber weapons exist that they've tested in a limited fashion in a closed loop that they just have sitting there waiting for the big day. It could be, and that day could be very devastating. Again, you want to have cash on hand because you may wake up some morning and find that if you log on to the internet, if there is an internet, to your bank account, it could show a zero balance, or the website for the bank may not come up at all. But nothing beats having precious metals in your personal possession. And the next thing down the list, of course, would be to have cash on hand. But I don't want to overemphasize cash because the dollar itself in the long term is doomed as a currency unit. I don't think it's going to be around another 10 or 15 years. So you don't want to have too much cash on hand. I'm a big believer in tangibles.
And maybe the cash is going to be very effective for maybe that very first stage of an event, maybe the first 3 to 4 days or week.
Right. When people, and that's where, you know, if it's a limited collapse or a slow slide collapse where the dollar retains its buying power, there you're going to need money so you can pay your bills. And if there's a banking crisis, checks may not be accepted. Credit cards may not be accepted. You may need to have cash, and you might actually, say there's a economic collapse of some sort, you might have to actually physically visit the local utility office and pay your utility bill in cash, or risk having your power cut off, or your water, or your phone service, or whatever. So it's important to have cash on hand.
Now, our southern border is wide open, and we just had another episode of workplace violence committed in Oklahoma by a follower of the religion of peace. What can we do to prepare for more of their brand of peace?
Well, obviously, people need to be well-armed and vigilant, especially for people who attend church regularly, or anyone in virtually any work environment in any good-sized city, and maybe even some smaller towns. If you're in an area that has a large Muslim population, you're at risk. And even for folks who live in, you know, Topeka, Kansas, who's to say that there won't be Muslim extremists that pick out a spot on the map and say, okay, we're going to take down this city. It could be individuals like the jihadi in Oklahoma, or it could be a group. I think the recent event in Kenya, where they had a shopping mall that was attacked by a large group of armed men, armed with just, you know, battle rifles and grenades, the police were so slow to respond. It was just ridiculous. And they went on a multi-hour killing spree, and they, you know, a lot of people had tried hiding in stores, and they basically hunted everyone down over the course of hours. So it's important to be armed and vigilant. I'm a big believer in both open carry and concealed carry. And for your listeners who are fortunate enough to live in a permit-less concealed carry state, and here I'm talking about Wyoming, Arizona, Vermont, Alaska, and was it Missouri recently added to the list? That's the ideal situation where you can carry concealed without a permit. Now, in some states like Idaho and Montana, you can carry concealed without a permit if you're outside of city limits, but inside a city you need a permit. But in those states and many other Western states, you can carry openly with no permit at all. And if people feel the need, I think that they, you know, should pray about it and then basically forget the social stigma. Just go ahead and carry. And if people ask you about it, consider it a good teaching opportunity. It's what they in the school system they refer to as a teachable moment. That's your chance to educate people about the Second Amendment. And I'm very fond of saying that any right that doesn't get exercised eventually can devolve into a privilege and may even get to the point of being declared a crime. So open carry actually in and of itself, even if there aren't that many specific threats, is a good thing because we're exercising that right. It's like a muscle that will atrophy if you don't use it. It's use it or lose it. So I'm a big believer in open carry.
And you mentioned that that you think that an EMP strike, the concerns over that are maybe not taken seriously enough. Our fearless leader may have just reignited the Cold War, and we already had no shortage of folks around the world who dislike us, and a lot of those folks have limited nuclear capabilities. Do you think that it's a bigger threat now than it has been in the past?
It is, but for your listeners who are self-sufficient and who live off-grid, the particular threat to someone who's off-grid is not all that great right within your own home. But if you're connected to the grid, basically all of your electronics that are plugged in are probably going to get fried by EMP or by a naturally occurring solar storm. If we have an X-class solar flare and it hits our side of we're facing the sun at the wrong time, the net effect will be about the same. So I do recommend that people be ready for EMP or solar flares. If you have spare radios, you really need to store them in a Faraday enclosure, and something as simple as an ammo can or even just a galvanized trash can with a tight-fitting lid works fine. An ammo can really probably should have some aluminum foil added around the top edge or steel wool. To get a good connection between the body of the ammo can and its lid. It has to be one complete enclosure that is connected electrically to itself. So that's the definition of a Faraday cage.
That would go the same for
all your spare electronics need to be stored. If you have a spare laptop, if you have a shortwave radio that you don't listen to on a regular basis, you really should put it in a trash can to protect it. Same goes for any other electronics that have microcircuits that you would normally have plugged into grid power. Folks who live off-grid, who live with just a micro hydro system or a photovoltaic system with just, the real threat of EMP is those miles and miles and miles of telephone lines and power lines that act like giant EMP antennas and direct that EMP right to your devices that are plugged in. So if you either live off-grid where you only have 20 feet of cabling that goes to your solar panels, your electronics really aren't that great of a risk unless you're right near a nuclear detonation. Or if you keep your electronics unplugged and in Faraday enclosures, you're going to be pretty well protected. But even if you and your family have taken all the right precautions, you've got to anticipate that nearly everyone else, including the banking system, the grocery stores, the trucking lines, everyone else is going to have all their electronics fried. And that would be enough just in itself to collapse the economy. And because of the fragility of our system and our great dependence on grid power, it could be months or years, or even decades before the power grid comes back up. That's my biggest fear, really, is any grid collapse that goes on for more than a year, it's very difficult to get things restarted. And we could literally be on the cusp of a second dark age.
And do you think that it's a good idea to, if you do have a backup solar photovoltaic system, is that a good idea to not have that in a grid tie-in?
Yes, I would recommend that you have a completely grid-independent system, and I know that means giving up, you know, all the lovely tax advantages, but being grid-tied is a threat just in itself. And most grid-tied systems usually don't have batteries, so they really are essentially useless for half of the day. You're going to have no power at all at night if you have a system without batteries. So it's important to have a system that is not grid-tied. Not only are you going to be not beholden to any government agency and their regulations, but it's also going to protect you from both EMP and solar flares.
And we talked briefly last time you were on the show about your new book, Liberators. For new listeners, can you tell us briefly about that?
Sure. Liberators is part of my Patriot series. It's basically the last book in the series. It's the fifth book. It's the longest book in the series, and it ties together a lot of the characters that were seen in the previous books and introduces some new ones. I chose for this particular book to have most of it set in Western Canada because I wanted to show how people living in northern, in the severe northern climate would be able to pull through a disaster of this magnitude. And I also, there's another group of characters who make it all the way from Washington, D.C. By various methods over the course of this disaster all the way to Idaho. And I wanted to show a couple of things with that group of characters. I wanted to show first my sympathy for all the folks who are tied to the D.C. Beltway and who are basically manacled there by golden handcuffs. They're stuck there because they're earning really good money, and either because of family situations or whatever, they basically can't make the break. And I wanted to illustrate how low the percentage chances are for most people in that situation to actually make it to a lightly populated area where they would be safe in the event of a widespread disaster that has a sudden onset.
And you also have a new nonfiction book coming out in December, Tools for Survival. Now, that book isn't just about the tools, but it's also about the skills that you need to be able to use those tools. Is that right?
That's right. I've often been quoted as saying that owning a gun doesn't make you a shooter any more than owning a surfboard makes you a surfer. There's a learning curve to every tool. Every tool has a learning curve. And a lot of people take for granted that they'll be able to pick up hand tools and, you know, suddenly, you know, carve out a new existence from the wilderness. They're just dreaming. Unless you really learn how to use your tools and learn a lot of forgotten 19th century skills, you're going to be really hurting. I even know contractors who, you know, got their start as building contractors after the advent of battery-powered tools and a wide assortment of corded tools. They don't even really know how to use a handsaw. It's kind of scary watching these people. Here they are, professional contractors, and they don't even know how to saw a straight line with a handsaw. So yeah, there's learning curves on all this stuff. Everything from cooking with a wood stove to growing a garden, working with small livestock, sewing by hand, sewing with a treadle sewing machine, working with hand tools, doing your own welding, your own brazing, your own casting. There's learning curves to all of them, and one area of particular concern is safety. Here we're talking about picking up new skills in an environment where you don't have access to 911 and an ambulance who's going to magically arrive 10 minutes later. We're talking about a situation where there will be no medical care available except your own. And here people are going to be working with fire and sharp instruments, sometimes for the first time. It's not a really good recipe there. It's kind of a recipe for disaster. So people need to come up to speed with all the tools they acquire early on. I do recommend that people get together with guild-type organizations. Like virtually every community will have like a fiber guild to learn how to spin wool and card it, to spin it, to dye it, to weave it, or to felt it. Find out about these organizations. Every community probably has a local chapter or a local club that's affiliated with the Amateur Radio Relay League, the ARRL, where you have ham radio people who have been around for years and years and who can bring you up to speed on all the ins and outs of how to set up an antenna and trim it and to get you on the air with ham radio gear. These are usually older people who are very generous with their time. They have a tremendous wealth of information. But if you try to wait until after everything hits the fan to learn how to operate a ham radio that's sitting in a box, you're probably not going to do very well. In fact, if you make the mistake of keying up the handset on a radio without an antenna connected, you're going to burn out the finals of that radio, and it's going to be, you know, absolutely worthless for anything but reception. So get to know your tools. Get together with the older folks in your community that have these skills and come up to speed. Here I'm talking about everything from, you know, canning produce from your garden to running a treadle sewing machine and zeroing your rifles, becoming combat ready with your rifles. There's a difference between just being a marksman and being a combat shooter. Get training from the very best folks you can find. In the case of shooting, the very best training that you can afford. I would much rather have one or two guns and a couple of thousand rounds of ammunition and go to a top-rated shooting school for rifle, handgun, shotgun than I would to have 10 or 15 guns and no training. That's just foolhardiness.
And both of your books are available for pre-order?
Yes, they are. The Liberator's novel comes out on October 21st of 2014, and the date has not been yet set for the Tools for Survival book. It is in the very final editing stages right now. That it's about ready to be sent off to the audiobook narrator, and it looks like it'll be probably coming out in mid-December, but that might actually get pushed back into January of 2015.
And for the folks that'd like to learn more, can you tell them where they can find your website? And then also maybe for the folks that are just coming on board with the need to prepare, can you just go over?
It's my website is survivalblog.com, all written as all one word, survivalblog.com. And, all the content there is available free of charge. There's no special members only area. All the archives that date all the way back to 2005 are completely searchable. Everything's free of charge. And there's just a tremendous wealth of information there that I recommend that people delve into. And again, there are a few static pages off in the left-hand column, like the Getting Started page and my List of List page. I highly recommend that people start there.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on. God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you.
In American Reset, the final chapter of the Economic Collapse Chronicles. The ultimate contest between liberty and tyranny reaches the apex. The Bear family and their neighbors learn the true value of community as they rely on each other to survive the war and the effects of the financial meltdown. Will the collapse bring an oppressive regime that enslaves the American people, or will the patriots prevail and guide the country back to a place of freedom, peace, and prosperity? Get your copy of American Reset in Kindle, paperback, or audio edition at Amazon.com today.